We're going to get started. The Judiciary Finance and Policy Committee, we don't yet have a quorum, so we can't present the bill, which is first on the agenda. And so we're actually going to have sentencing guidelines go first, if they're ready, talking about sentencing guidelines and their budget. And I have a budget book in my office somewhere. That'd be great. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Kelly Mitchell, and I'm Executive Director of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. Are you able to see that now? Okay. All right, so we've already been here to tell you a little bit about what the Sentencing Guidelines Commission does. Today we're just going to go over our budget. So when we were here last time, we explained that the commission is made up of representatives from each of the major stakeholders in the criminal justice community, and the role of the commission itself is to establish sentencing policy. And behind the scenes, we have a staff of six, one executive director, that's me, one trainer, and four researchers. And our role is to support the commission in their policymaking work and to ensure that the guidelines are being used and understood by criminal practitioners in the criminal justice field. So in order to support the work of the commission, our staff performs a number of functions. First, we collect data. That's the reason that we have data going back to 1981, and we are able to analyze sentencing practices and trends over the years. With that data, we put out annual reports on overall trends, as well as specific trends in areas like assaults, criminal sexual conduct, and DWI. Our trainer puts on multiple trainings across the state. This was our second year implementing web-based training, so in addition to the annual trainings that we do in the classroom each fall that go along with the release of our guidelines, we were also able to do a number of one-hour, topic-specific web-based trainings for practitioners across the state to try to troubleshoot some of those areas that maybe they have a little more trouble figuring out, like DWI and domestic abuse cases. One of the important ways that we work with fellow agencies and criminal justice practitioners is also to provide data in response to requests. In 2012, we responded to over 100 data requests, and those are made by lawyers and judges and practitioners who are working within the court trying to figure out how have things been sentenced in the past, if when they have a case that may be unique to them. It's also sometimes academics doing research on general sentencing policy. And we also provide the same service here to the legislature. Finally, we do have staff that work every day answering questions for practitioners in the field. Sometimes that involves a judge or an attorney calling us to make sure they've got the sentence right as they're headed into court. Sometimes the call is from a probation officer as he or she is trying to complete the sentencing worksheet. And these calls, involve real-time implementation of the guidelines and help to ensure that sentencing policy is being implemented as the commission and the legislature intended. So in terms of our budget, we have a two-year budget of $1.17 million. 83% of that goes to salaries, and 17% of that goes to operating expenses. For this next biennium, we're not asking for a change to the base. This is what we currently have. We've had some staffing changes at the commission, so even if the labor contracts that are under review right now are approved, we can absorb any of those changes with the current funding that we have. So we're not requesting a change in that base. Just as a comparison to other states, these are a few of the other states that have commissions that are similar in size to ours and have sentencings that they handle roughly the same volume of cases that we do. And you'll see that Minnesota's doing pretty well. We have a little bit smaller commission, a little bit smaller complement, but we actually produce quite a bit with that complement.
I can interrupt for just one moment. We'll officially call the meeting to order. We now have a quorum. Go ahead.
Thank you. So the one thing that we are here to request this year is a one-time funding request to to revise and replace our electronic worksheet system. So what we're asking for is $300,000 in the first year of the biennium. This is just a one-time request. It wouldn't require any, it wouldn't be an ongoing expense or require ongoing maintenance funding. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about what our sentencing worksheet system is and what the funding would go to do. So a sentencing worksheet is the tool that probation agents use to assist in applying the guidelines to calculate the presumptive sentence. The presumptive sentence is primarily determined by two things: the severity level of the offense and the criminal history score of the offender. That sounds like two numbers that should be fairly simple to figure out. And last time we were here, we showed you the grid and showed you how you put those together to find the cell that contains the presumptive sentence. But there are a lot of rules and sort of things that go on underneath that make it not a straightforward calculation. So for instance, criminal history itself is made up of four things: the felony record of the offender, the prior juvenile offenses, prior misdemeanors and gross misdemeanors, and whether the offender was under a custody status when they committed the current offense. So whether they maybe were on probation or were serving a jail term. So just to sort of figure out which of those things should be included and should not be included sometimes takes a little bit of work, and our sentencing worksheet helps the probation officer work through those types of issues. On top of that, there are mandatory minimum sentences. Sometimes there's attempts. So there are other factors that go into calculating the sentence. So all of this is what the worksheet is helping the probation officer sort of work through to come up with that final presumptive sentence that they will recommend to the court. So once that's done, basically we have an electronic system that all of this is done in. The probation officer goes in, they enter the information, the worksheet is generated. What happens at that point is it's then sent over to my office. This all happens electronically behind the scenes. One of the researchers in my office will review that worksheet, make sure that the guidelines have been applied correctly, and if they have, they'll release it to the probation officer. If the guidelines haven't been applied correctly, they'll flag it as an issue, and they'll contact the officer and work with that person to figure out what the correct calculation is. So we have that intervening step for every worksheet. In 2010, we reviewed almost 17,000 worksheets, and it's estimated that an average of 15 per day required follow-up with the agent. The worksheet system, the data that's in there, then becomes one of the sort of building blocks of the data that we collect and analyze as throughout the year. So what happens is at the end of the month, all of the worksheets that have been entered and completed in that system get downloaded to the commission office. Then we get the actual sentencing information from the court. We match those two together, and that starts to form the data that we collect and track. When we're matching those together, we often find, you know, sometimes there's a sentence without a worksheet or a worksheet without a sentence, and so we're able to sort of work through those and figure out what's going on. Oftentimes there will be something that happened during the sentencing proceeding in court that, you know, maybe didn't happen quite right, and we're able to intervene and get that corrected. So it is working. You know, the system we have is working, so why do we want to rewrite it? Well, there's a couple of reasons for that. Number one, the electronic worksheet is currently housed on the statewide supervision system. And this is a system that is located at the Department of Corrections. There are a lot of different modules within that system. It's where jail and booking information is kept, and probation supervision information is also kept there. Most of the modules have been moved over to a new platform over the past few years, and the electronic worksheet system is the last one left on the old platform. Probation officers can still access our system, but the two platforms don't talk together perfectly, so we do experience some problems on a day-to-day basis. So we'd like to move our system over to the new platform where everything else is. But when we do that, we'd like to take the opportunity to build in some automation so that we can reduce some of the errors that we see as worksheets are being produced. So let me talk through a couple of those things we'd like to build in that will make worksheets even better than they are today. So the first one is that when a probation officer initiates a sentencing worksheet, they do have to enter case information. So they're physically typing in the case name, the offender's name, the case number, county, date of offense, things like that. So we would build an integration to the courts so that we can get that information to come right into the system automatically. It eliminates data entry, saves a little bit of time, and then we also eliminate the errors that might occur just from typing. The second thing we'd like to do is give the probation officer the ability to bring criminal history forward from worksheets that have already been completed. Sometimes we have repeat offenders in the system, or we might be dealing with multiple felony offenses being sentenced at the same time. Each one requires its own worksheet. So if the probation officer is able to copy and paste that criminal history, it just goes a lot faster. Again, you eliminate some of the data entry errors. But we also want to build in some automatic data checks so that we can help the officers apply the guidelines correctly. So a couple of things that we'd like to look for are decay periods. You know, felonies are only valid as criminal history for 15 years. So if we find a felony that's being used that may have passed that 15-year period, we'd be able to give the officer a warning up front so that they could review it and decide whether it really should be included or not. We'd also be checking for mandatory minimums, so if there's a sentence that needs to be imposed because there's a legislatively determined sentence there, the mandatory minimum would pop up on that offense. Juvenile history decays when the offender turns 25, it can no longer be used, so we'd check for the offender's age, let them know that that might be an issue. And then conditional release terms would automatically sort of pop up for the probation officer. We'd also like the system to actually calculate the presumptive sentence, so we'd like to have the grid residing behind the scenes so that once we have determined the appropriate offense severity and criminal history, we can pull in the presumptive sentence automatically. And at that time, we can also do the check to see if there might be a mandatory minimum that overrides the guideline sentence, to see if there has been an attempt indicated on the case, then we can help. We can, you know, cut that number in half. That's what the law does. So we'd have this opportunity to make sure that all of the factors that go into determining that presumptive sentence are actually applied. And then finally, we'd just like to build in some email notification for the officer. As I mentioned, we review all of the worksheets at the Sentencing Guidelines Commission before they're released. Right now, the officer goes in, they complete the worksheet, and then they have to go back into the system to figure out whether we're done with it. So if we just have a simple email notification to them, they'll know immediately that it's done or that there's an issue that they need to go address, and that will just make the system flow a lot faster. So the Department of Corrections routinely does surveys to find out how much time the different functions of a probation officer take up, and they found that a sentencing worksheet takes about an hour and a half to complete. So when we think about the number of worksheets that we have each year, that's nearly 25,000 hours spent figuring out the presumptive sentence with the worksheet. We asked probation officers how much time they thought the automation that we were looking at would save them, and they thought it would be 15 to 30 minutes per worksheet, so that works out to 4,000 to 8,000 hours a year. So we think that's a good savings for probation officers. The total cost of the project is $490,000. We already have $200,000 of that, and so we're just looking for the remaining $300,000 for this year. So with that, I'll stand for any questions.
Questions from members. Representative Nehmer.
What's the potential savings from switching over?
Ms. Mitchell.
Chair Hillstrom and Representative McNamer, are you asking for... we know the potential time savings.
No, I'm dollar savings.
Dollar savings?
Right.
Ms. Mitchell, wait, gotta go through the chair. So, Ms. Mitchell.
I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I We do not have the budget for the probation officers, so I honestly don't know. I just know how many hours we think it will save them, but I don't know how that turns into dollars.
Representative Panama.
No, I'm satisfied.
Ms. Mitchell, will this be completely integrated then with the e-discovery system and the e-court plan that we've been hearing about already, so that these then can be filed electronically with the court? Ms. Mitchell.
Representative Hillstrom, this will not take it to the place where the worksheet can then be filed electronically with the court. That would take another integration at the end of the project. But I have talked with the courts, and this project will set us up to be able to do that once we get this piece done. They're not ready to receive it from us electronically, and we would need to do this before we're even in a position to send it electronically. But that is the goal, is to get to that point.
And any timeline on when that integration might be able to be done, Ms. Mitchell?
Representative Hillstrom, this project would take us about a year, so we anticipate that it would take through the first half of the biennium to get this piece done. Once it's done, then we can talk to the courts. It's my understanding that their timeline for the criminal side of things is over the next 2 years, so I think that it would be about 2 years out before we could do that.
Questions from members? Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Commissioner Roy's here. I wonder if he could address Representative McNamer's question.
Commissioner Roy?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. I believe the slide showed an 8,000-hour savings, and I would approximate $30 an hour per probation officer, but obviously the workload issues, it's not exactly like that savings in time will result in actual budget savings, but certainly in a workload stratification more so, that they would obviously do other tasks during that time.
Other questions from members? All right, seeing none, thank you. Members, we will not be bringing this crew back until we put together the budget. All right, next.
Can somebody chair the committee tonight so I can move that together?
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, I would move that House File 90 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register.
Go ahead, Representative Hillstrom, and present your bill.
Thank you, members. Members, this bill was brought to me by the Vulnerable Adults Justice Project. They have been working, as you know, on ways to deal with the issue of financial exploitation of vulnerable adults. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to them. We'll start with Iris Spring.
Thank you very much, Representative Hillstrom, Madam Chair, and members. My name is Iris Freeman, and I'm the Associate Director of the Center for Elder Justice and Policy at William Mitchell College of Law. I'm a social worker by profession, and I've worked for something in the area of 35 years on vulnerable adult protection services and policy. The center is the host for the Vulnerable Adult Justice Project, which is a statewide collaborative of law enforcement, social services, healthcare, and advocacy groups. And there's a good long list of the participating agencies and associations on the reverse side of the handout that's coming around. Since 2007, we have been meeting on a monthly basis to work on issues of combating abuse, neglect, and financial exploitation of older people and vulnerable adults through a number of means, through building community awareness, improving practice, and certainly through strengthening laws. Given the size of our group and the diversity of its partners, the bills that we bring forward are bills that have been subject to the consensus of the group. House File 90 had its start in our criminal code working group, and Mary Lynch from the Hennepin County Attorney's Office will talk to the substance of the bill.
Ms. Lynch, go ahead and identify yourself for the tape and present your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mary Lynch. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney. I'm speaking today on behalf of the Vulnerable Adult Justice Project.
Go ahead.
Thank you. House File 90 contains two segments. The first is an aggregation statute. The Vulnerable Adult Justice Project sees this as a clarification and refinement of current law. It is specifically designed to address how crimes that involve separate transactions should be addressed within the financial exploitation statute. Several theft and related statutes allow aggregation, which essentially allows smaller dollar amounts, that would be usually amounts under $1,000, to be aggregated and considered as single counts in order to allow for effective charging and prosecution. The 2009 Vulnerable Adults Act made financial exploitation over $35,000 a separately defined crime, and we see the aggregation statute as going along with that to make it clear how courts and prosecutors should address this issue. For example, without aggregation, an offense that involved $130,000 that was taken over about 18 months would probably only be able to be charged as a single count. But with aggregation, with the clarification of aggregation, it can be charged as three counts. It also helps to inform judges and prosecutors, defense attorneys, and everybody involved in these cases how to approach the cases in terms of charging, sentencing, and will allow for more consistent practice. It is our perception in the Vulnerable Adult Justice Project that there is some inconsistencies in practice, both in the courts and in prosecution, with the dollar amounts of the statute. So we think that by placing this aggregation provision within the financial exploitation part of the statute, that it would make it clear to everybody involved how to address those issues. The second portion deals with venue. This is a new provision. It would be an expansion. It, however, would not expand the potential crimes that are prosecuted, but makes it clear, like identity theft, that financial exploitation of vulnerable adults could be prosecuted, charged and prosecuted, either where transactions occurred or where the vulnerable adult victim or victims lives. These are crimes that frequently happen over both time and space. Frequently, the vulnerable adult, for example, lives in one county, and the vulnerable adult's finances and the suspect or defendant lives in another county. Mm-hmm. By allowing venue to lie where the vulnerable adult lives, it allows the investigators to more closely align with the civil process that happens within adult protection, where investigations happen through the common entry point and tend almost always come from where the vulnerable adult lives. Allowing venue in the criminal statute to lie where the vulnerable adult lives allows for more effective prosecution, so we're not duplicating efforts in criminal investigations that have already occurred in the civil investigation. It also allows, and this is an important piece, allows the investigators, the law enforcement investigators, to work more closely with prosecutors who they're used to working with and with adult protection investigators who they are able to develop collaborations and work with. This will allow for much more efficient investigations and ultimately, I think, more consistent and more fair prosecutions. The flexibility is also important. There are different dynamics that go on. These cases are very difficult for investigators to work on, to investigate, to work up. And allowing for flexibility in determining where the prosecution should happen makes it more likely that the individual facts will get a good, close look and the prosecutions can go forward. And finally, as with identity theft, which is a statute that has similar venue provisions, witnesses can frequently live in one county or in one geographical place that is quite different from where the transactions happen. And so allowing the venue to lie where, again, where the vulnerable adult lives or where the transactions happen make it much more likely that we'll be able to access witnesses both for investigative and for prosecution purposes. And that is all I have.
Questions from members? Representative Scott.
Thank you. I love the intent of this bill. I have some questions because I'm not real familiar with what current law says, but
How do you know that the property is stolen and not given to a person?
Representative Hillstrom?
I think.
Okay. Well, many times the question is it a gift? And the investigation goes to first, was the vulnerable adult capable of consenting? Mm-hmm. And did the person who had the property or took the property know that that person was not capable of consenting? In many instances, that's real clear. And in many instances, it's not. But that will go to the proof, whether you can prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt or not.
Representative Scott.
And then, you know, I see the six-month aggregate. So will the really bad actors just take a couple things every 6 months then to avoid, I mean, to, you know what I'm saying?
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Scott, typically this is ongoing and it happens over a long period of time and you find out about it much later. This would give prosecutors the ability to decide if it's ongoing conduct, you can aggregate everything together in many instances, but this makes the six-month delineation much more clear as with other statutes that currently exist.
Okay. Representative Scott.
Thank you.
Representative McNamer.
Madam Chair, this deals with power of attorney. Not at all. Power of attorney has sweeping powers that are given to the recipient, and that can be abused also. Oh,
Representative Hillstrom.
Madam Chair, Representative McNamer, sit tight. There's a power of attorney bill coming.
Okay.
But indeed, the types of financial exploitation that victimize vulnerable adults can happen through direct thefts of property in the household. They can occur through misuse of documents such as the power of attorney and any number of other financial relationships. And so there's a tie, but this is not directly about any specific kind of exploitation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you can prosecute under this statute if there's a power of attorney that's being abused. I just want to make that clear. This just isn't making any change at this point to that statute, but you will see other pieces yet this session.
Representative McNamer.
Point of reference, if you have a vulnerable adult that can no longer stay in their home and has to have nursing home care, and you liquidate their property to help pay for their stay, but you don't receive the amount that the property was valued at. For instance, if you have an auction, you have to pay a 20% auctioneer fee. Could that be considered misuse of funds?
Ms. Lynch?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm representative, typically no, that there would need to be a criminal intent involved, which would involve essentially defrauding or seeking to provide it. The criminal statute specifically excludes misuse or mismanagement. There needs to be an additional level of intent there.
One more question.
Representative McNamer.
If you sell the property below estimated market value, could that be considered a misuse of funds?
Ms. Lynch.
Thank you, Representative McNamer. Again, there would need to be a level of criminal intent there. It would depend. It could potentially be part of a scheme, truthfully, that would involve a transfer of funds, could also implicate other issues like assets that are hidden under medical assistance analysis, things like that. But again, there would, for criminal prosecution, we would need to be able to prove an additional level of intent, and we would need to have that in context.
Thank you.
Representative McNamer. Any other questions members have? Representative Hillstrom. Representative Lean has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess just one quick question going back to the power of attorney. Would the power of attorney be held liable in the same sense, under the same, I don't know, degree as the person who were to buy the funds? For example, let's say the power of attorney was selling property to somebody else, and they were basically scheming on that. Would they be held in the same, not the same case, but in the same degree of liability?
Representative Hillstrom. Ms. Lynch.
Thank you. Representative Lean, potentially yes, either as an individual actor or as aiding and abetting of the overall scheme. Yes.
Representative Lean.
Thank you.
Any other questions before it looks like Representative Hellstrom would like to sum up?
Madam Chair, actually, there was a fiscal note requested on this, and if we would like to go to Mr. Walls, he can address why you don't have a copy of the fiscal note in your packet.
Mr. Walls.
Madam Chair and members, a fiscal note was requested on this bill. So far, all of the four agencies involved have responded and basically responded that they have no cost in relation to this bill. It is in the system as preliminary. It's been signed off on by the EBO in all four cases, but it has not been finalized for some reason by the system, which is questionable. But all four agencies have responded with no cost.
Mr. Walls, would you like to define EBO for the new members?
EBO is the Executive Budget Officer at MMB, and they're responsible for signing off on the accuracy and content of the fiscal notes before they become official.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Hellstrom, would you like to renew your motion that House File 90 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. Members, I just want to make a quick announcement. The public defenders were originally scheduled for today. They are not able to make it, so we have no other business for this week. We will start with the court's budget next week.
Representative McNamer, have you read the minutes?
Madam Chair, I have, and I move to pass them.
Representative McNamer moves the adoption of the minutes from February 5th. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails. The minutes from February 5th are adopted. Members, the meeting is adjourned.